Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I'm Ron Edwards, and this is the Don and Ron program coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, if you will. A lot going on across the country. A lot going on across the world, and tonight we're going to take a look at some of the events that has put the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul front and center in regards to another one of those police misconduct. This one went to court, and the police officer was exonerated, if you will. The Castile case has come to an end as it pertains to the criminal part of the process, if you will. A jury in the city of St. Paul, which represents Ramsey County, found Officer Geronimo Yanez innocent of all charges of manslaughter, endangerment, and etc. Many feel that this was a surprise and a shock. In fact, we have just come from a listening session at the Urban League of Minneapolis in North Minneapolis. Over 60-some citizens showed up to sit and quietly talk and analyze their feelings about what happened, what did not happen, what did happen, in the context of justice and etc. It is the feeling of many, including this commentator, this was not served. But we knew that this case involving Mr. Castile had been lost when the attorneys for Officer Yanez successfully, and almost without precedent, it is very rare here in the state of Minnesota, for a presiding judge or a judge that has been selected according to the process to be removed without cause. And of course, in this case, it was the skin color of the judge, the very honorable Edward Wilson, the most senior judge, by the way, not the most senior African-American, because there's only two African-Americans on the Ramsey County District Court bench, but the most senior judge, most respected, if you will, a man who certainly is considered to be certainly a moderate as it pertains to his judicial rulings and etc., has not had a disproportionate number of reversals and etc. And so when the attorneys played the race card right out of the bat, if you will, it surprised some folks. It really did not surprise us. It is one of the few criticisms we have of John Choi, the Ramsey County attorney, who did charge Officer Yanez, if you will, that he took that step, which could cost him dearly as it pertains to a reelection as county attorney for Ramsey County, which also, by the way, Ramsey County is the county in which the seat of government here in the state of Minnesota is located, the state capital, et cetera, is, of course, the city of St. Paul. There's a lot of hurt and anger, as we were quoted in Sunday's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. There are many who feel that once again, the AFTI, their supporters and others of color have been betrayed, if you will, that the rug of justice has been jerked out from under them, which happens so frequently. We were just watching before we went on the air a broadcast of a officer, white officer, being exonerated and found innocent in Milwaukee in a shooting that took place a couple of years ago. And so we are not surprised, and we're not surprised. We were disappointed. As a longtime activist, if you will, we've been out here since 1958 And so we understand the history, and we have basically personally been involved with every major shooting case in the Twin Cities in which African Americans have lost their lives at the hands of the police. I never really had the secure feeling going into the Yanis trial that it was going to be any different. One could sense that. And so when the political move was made to play the race card by the attorneys for Geronimo Yanis, if you will, Attorney Kelly and Attorney Gray, two attorneys who pretend to be liberal and et cetera, but in fact do not represent the liberal cloth of justice in the world that we reside in. And so it was an interesting trial. It a two-week trial. The jury was out for 4 days, if you will. But on Friday of last week, the jury came back with a unanimous verdict indicating that the officer had not violated any aspect of the law. The expectation is that the Castile family will sue for civil damages. There will probably be a settlement prior to going to any kind of trial. We would estimate that it would probably be as low as $1 million and no higher than $2 million. And the reason is that the officer stood trial. Unprecedented in modern times here in the state of Minnesota, the officer stood trial, not since the days of, you know, cowboys in the 1850s, 1840s here in Minnesota, had a peace officer, a law enforcement officer, been charged with violating the right of a citizen during the course of that citizen being shot and killed. And so in modern times, it had never happened, and that's the reason we said earlier that the Ramsey County Attorney John Choi could be targeted, if you will, by conservative and pro-police elements when he stands for re-election in a couple of years. But it was a gathering tonight of over 60 individuals, a mixture of black and white, primarily probably 90% African Americans, which was good because there was a feeling that the African American community had become almost indifferent to the fact that there is no justice, if you will, no peace, and that the future for justice for African Americans, particularly those killed by law enforcement, or for that matter, any Caucasian, because we've had a number of cases here in which whites who have permits to carry have shot and killed African Americans. In fact, the media and in the respective counties that this happens, primarily Hennepin and Ramsey County, the media has cooperated in not identifying the Caucasian. In fact, we just had a Caucasian shoot and kill an African-American. They did exchange gunfire in South Minneapolis about 2 weeks ago. Many of you that even live here in the city of Minneapolis of Twin Cities were not aware that that the individual who shot the African-American, now the authorities say that the young African-American was attempting to stick up the Caucasian, if you will. They exchanged gunfire. The African-American ran about two blocks and collapsed and was found dead and with his a gun in his hand. But this is the fifth death of an African-American at the hands of a Caucasian. And what other situation was at the hands of an Asian, by the way, in which immediately the authorities indicated that the individual in question was within his rights and that the African-American was, in fact, in the course of violating the law. Preliminary evidence and et cetera would indicate that that is possibly true, but there's no way of really knowing because the matter never goes to a grand jury. and you merely had the word of the investigators that the Caucasian was within his rights to execute the constitutional authority that had been provided to him, and that was to allow him to have a permit to carry, and that he executed, quote-unquote, that constitutional right, and in the course of that, of course, executed another human being, a person of color, if you will. And so it was interesting tonight at the meeting in North Minneapolis to hear the broad spectrum of views and reflections and anger and frustration, but it was well managed, if you will. The African Americans and the Caucasians that were there were clearly on their, I don't want to say on their best behavior, because that's not even appropriate, but they clearly knew what the mission was, and that was to dialogue, make recommendations, express what they were feeling in a manner in which, you know, no one would be able to accuse them of acting like savages and banshees and the kinds of names that are given to those of us in the African-American community. A video from the what is called the dash cam was released yesterday by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, BCA, here in Minnesota, who has a sweetheart relationship, particularly in cases in which African Americans or others of color are the victims of police misconduct. And the BCA released a video in which there was all of this conjecture, if you will, and expressions that there would be rioting in the streets and Negroes, quote-unquote, would be out of control and et cetera. Well, the community conducted itself in an appropriate manner, consistent with people who understand what it is that they need to do to make sure that their message is delivered. And so this commentator saw that tonight in North Minneapolis with over 60-some citizens on a beautiful day. It's been beautiful here in the Twin Cities, in Minneapolis and St. Paul. In fact, the families of two of the most recent individuals to be shot and killed by the police, Jamar Clark's father and the Castile, members of the Castile family, were at this talking point meeting, if you will, reflecting on very quietly. There were, as I said, over 60-some people. There were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, about eight the big table. And people were quietly talking, discussing. There were recorders, if you will, in other words, people keeping notes and et cetera, which will be transcribed, if you will, and be made available to organizations that were involved. Now, one of the angles that has emerged that is rather disturbing to some degree is that people are saying that there is a serious mental health problem within the African-American community. I mean, there are problems within the African-American community, but there are mental health problems throughout America, or you wouldn't have had a Caucasian from Belleville, Illinois, trying to kill every Republican that he could get to. And by the way, let us say this, that we need to have an appreciation that it was two African-American law enforcement officers, one female and one male, who actually saved the Congress of the United States and current government from a serious crisis, because as many as 14, 15, 16 Republican congressmen could have been killed if these two African-American, again, one male, one female, had not engaged the gunman, who was heavily armed with an assault rifle, and at least 10 or 12 bullets, with that way they wanted, if you will, to reload and et cetera. And the reason we say that is that the like we did is that the two African American officers were totally outgunned, if you will. They had come to protect the majority whip of the United States House of Representatives. They just really, no one imagined that there would be a raging gun battle in which over 100 shots were fired, if you will. The gunman alone fired at least 60 shots or more as he changed magazines. He had at least, as we were just saying, kind of, he had at least nine magazines with him. He had come to Washington from Southern Illinois almost 2 months prior. He had been stalking the Republicans, if you will, living out of his truck, leaving his wife many years back in Illinois, if you will. According to the authorities, he had said something along the lines that he missed her and he was thinking about it. But he already knew what he intended to do, because on the Monday before the, what was it, Wednesday shooting, if you will, he canceled his YMCA card. And clearly he knew that he would not be around to participate in any YMCA activities. But again, we find it interesting on how dismissive the American Fourth Estate, the journalists and et cetera, have been in basically just kind of reporting that two African-American law enforcement officers engaged this gunman in a fierce firefight. Both were wounded, if you will. And everybody just kind of moves on now. Of course, everyone is concerned about the majority whip, if you will, a congressman from Louisiana, in fact, a suburb just north of New Orleans. His congressional district is located there. But there's just been kind of a dismissal that that's what the, you know, black folks are supposed to do. We repeat again, if that gunman had come in through the first base side as opposed to trying to come in through the third base side, he would have been able to have a clearer field of fire. He would have had individuals pinned down in the dugouts, if you will, and probably could have killed as many as 30 individuals. Certainly he would have been able to kill as many as 14 Republican congressmen who were bunkered down in that dugout, but did not have the kind of security, if you will, protection, if you will, that would have allowed them to survive. And so, again, we want to say for the third time to these two African-American law enforcement officers, God bless you on behalf of the United States of America. In fact, the president, and yes, we still have an imperial president, really was kind of stumbling around with regards to when to indicate his concern, just as he did with regards to two white male heroes in Portland, Oregon, who gave their lives to a madman, to a neo-Nazi, you know, who slashed them to death as he tried to attack two young women of color, one a Muslim, and was attempting to do bodily harm, and et cetera. These two men, joined by a third who is now recovering from his injuries, lost their lives, if you will. Two white Americans standing up for righteousness. And there just cannot be enough said about that. We talked about this on our television program last week here from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis. And we had materials and et cetera sent to us by our associates on the West Coast showing pictures and et cetera. We think it's important that that be said. Now, back to the perceived conditions. CNN has rushed reporters in here since late Saturday night, early Saturday morning, if you will, anticipating a a series of confrontations and et cetera. Of course, the authorities, the police are ready, you know, for any confrontation. Some folks have said that there has been no attempt to mend fences and et cetera. And in some regards, it is difficult to do that because the only law enforcement jurisdiction in the immediate area that has, in fact, done that with a very elaborate program under their chief of police, Janae Harto, put in place a reform act, if you will, a series of reforms, which included the use of deadly force after the tragic death of Jamar Clark in November of 2015 here in the Twin Cities, right on Plymouth Avenue North, two and a quarter blocks away from the 4th Precinct Police Station, and et cetera. Other departments have not taken that kind of proactive measures, if you will. St. Paul, which would be probably the second law enforcement department in the state of Minnesota behind Minneapolis. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Department may be number two. They have just a tad over 800 officers, so they probably actually are number two. St. Paul is number three, if you will, with close to 500 officers. Yes, let me correct. So the largest departments are Minneapolis Police Department, the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department, the St. Paul Police Department, and then probably the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, and then all others fall into place, if you will. And so there's already been a lot of discussion here in the Twin Cities about what will happen, what won't happen, what can be done. Was justice served in the actions by the court? Certainly they were not. As we said earlier in this program, the inaction, the inability of our civil rights organizations to challenge the ruling that was requested to remove the African-American judge, Edward Wilson, without cause, if you will, even though the judiciary rules indicate that there needs to be an indication of cause, particularly if certain questions are raised. Unfortunately, the Ramsey County attorney did not raise the question of race, if you will, and it was interesting to see a couple of jurors that were on the jury just yesterday indicate that race was never a consideration. You know, that is so sad because the actual probable cause, though he the officer, lied as he talked to Mr. Castile just moments before he was to take his life. He said it was your stoplight, your and et cetera. Actually, when Officer Yanis, let's say 8 or 9 minutes before he killed Mr. Castile, indicated that Mr. Castile, because of the configuration of his face, a big wide nose and dark skin and et cetera, and he looked like a African-American suspect who had allegedly robbed a convenience store 5 or 6 days earlier. Clearly, race was the prima facie, as the attorneys like to say, the probable cause, the reason for, quote-unquote, the action and et cetera, was that he was an African-American with a broad nose, if you will. I mean, that really, and we repeat that particular Latin term again, of the officer in making the stop, which then ultimately led to a sudden confrontation and the death of Mr. Castile, who was shot 5 times. The officer fired his weapon 7 times. Mr. Castile was hit 5 times and actually died almost instantly, though his last breath, he said, I was not trying to draw the weapon, in which he had indicated that he did have a weapon. He also the girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, had indicated that he also had a permit, and of course everybody saw that last year on July 6th, 2016, and et cetera. Unfortunately, Ms. Reynolds had some problems with the altercation having nothing to do with the stop six, seven months later. And juries always lie. Jurors are the best people in the world, no matter who they are, who always say that they have no information, never read about the case, don't know anything about the case, can't remember anything, and et cetera. Everyone sitting on that jury, 10 whites and two persons of color, one an Ethiopian young lady who had been here about 10 years. She was 18 years old. And an African-American male who was kind of, you know, troubling, if you will, because when he left the courthouse after the verdict, I mean, you know, you've just taken on a somber responsibility and duty, and then this brother's walking on the sidewalk laughing, you know, and smiling into the camera and et cetera, I guess, pumped up on his photo op. The media is now saying that two white jurors held out for 4 days before they were wore down. Our sources tell us a little something different, that one African-American and one white female, let me be absolutely concise, the one African-American, or the one black female, the Ethiopian young lady, and a Caucasian woman were the two that were holding out. Of course, now the system is, you know, talking in terms that it's all for the pursuit of justice and et cetera. But we take you back, those many listeners that we have tonight who have never gotten this piece of information. You have to go back and research the newspapers 6 weeks ago. Type in the Yanis trial, type in Earl Gray, and then type in Judge Edward Wilson. You'll find all the information that we have just reported all there, all in place, if you will. That was crucial because, by and large, the back of any opportunity of justice was in fact destroyed once it was established that the race card could be played. They knew that the only witness that they had to worry about, other than the 4-year-old daughter, Diamond Reynolds, was Miss Reynolds, if you will. And yeah, they did a pretty effective job, knowing that the jury knew that she had been, unfortunately, in an altercation, and that she is looking at some charges later on, if you will, behind the altercations in which there was some struggles and fighting between her, accompanied by two other women, and a fourth woman who had become the target of these ladies, if you will. And so the jurors were already positioned to be able to say that the prime witness, if you will, other than Officer Yanis himself, was this African-American girlfriend who is a person of bad character, if you will. And the attorneys for Officer Yanis did an excellent job, really, you know, in tearing her apart. Also, there was the whole issue, and we're here at Black at the Ron and Don program, we are clear and concise. We don't play games and try to hide the facts. And so it was quite obvious that the issue of the conduct of Miss Reynolds was going to come into play, and the judge was going to let it into play. But here's something that was also interesting, any of you in our domestic and international audience. At some point, day three, the jury asked to see the transcript of Officer Yanis' deposition, if you will, in the pretrial examination. And the judge turned him down, which was kind of interesting. That could have been something on appeal, but it's very rare for a government entity that is serving as prosecution to make that move. It seems to be something that, it just seems to be something that is not considered to be in line and consistent with regards to the courts, how the courts look upon the role of the prosecution, the government's entity, in challenging the validity and the integrity and the veracity and even the conduct and the history of a sitting judge. And so all of this was in play as an Irish judge, if you will, who actually may have been more than an associate and friend of Mr. Kelly and Mr. Gray, the two prime lead white attorneys for Office of Youngness, that they may have had a much closer affiliation and relationship. Now, in this state, at this particular hour, that is not supposed to be discussed, if you will. The media has not touched it. But for a hot moment a couple of months ago, when the motion was made for Judge Wilson to remove himself, there was a hint that there was a record of impropriety by the black judge, and et cetera. Of course, that was all fake, if you will. Both attorneys Kelly and Gray, representing the police officer, knew that that was a part of racial sensationalism to continue to darken and taint the waters, if you will, and to destroy Judge Wilson, as we said earlier, one of the most respected judges in the state of Minnesota. And by the way, let's just, in front of, so you understand what a white state we are, you know, we're actually right up there proportionally with Montana, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, and et cetera. We only have black judges in three counties, and they're all in close proximity to each other. Hennepin County, in which the city of Minneapolis is the primary city, has four African-American judges, has never had any more than five. Ramsey County, where the trial took place, has never had any more than three African-American judges, but they have two at this time. And Anoka County, which is to the north of both Ramsey County and Hennepin County, the county seat there being the city of Anoka, has one African-American judge. And in fact, he became just 2 years ago the first African-American appointed to the bench in Anoka County by Democratic Governor Mark Dayton, if you will. Seems to be doing well there, and we assume will not be unseated. Anoka is a kind of interesting county, but it is becoming extremely diverse with a large numbers of black folks moving in, particularly to the municipalities of Fridley and Blaine, and actually also in and around the city of Anoka. And so it's not like we have a history here of having a contingent of black judges that we could count on two hands, if you will. We can get through probably three-fourths of two hands, if you will. But it's something that liberals do not talk about here, you know what I mean, here in the land of Hubert Humphrey and Eugene McCarthy and et cetera. And, it's just like, you know, we have a hard time hiring African-Americans to be in police departments, if you will. In fact, the largest contingent of African-American police officers is in the 860-member Minneapolis Police Department, where there are about 66, 67 African-American police officers, male and female. City of St. Paul has around 37, 38. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Department, with over 800, has about 8 or 9 black deputies, I guess. Ramsey County, which has about probably 300 and some, over 300 and some deputies, has about 6 or 7 deputies, as I understand it. Anoka County has none. St. Louis County, in which Duluth is the county seat, I understand it a couple months ago, has one African-American sheriff's deputy who basically serves as more like a bailiff for the St. Louis County District Court, if you will. So that's how things kind of work up here in the land of liberalism, if you will, a great opportunity. Now, we actually have a rather interesting number of African Americans in our legislature. We have two state senators, black state senators. We only now have one African American in our legislature. And for the first time in 30-some years, we have no African American on the Minneapolis City Council, and we have none on the St. Paul City Council. We have had in our history one black, who was also the first female to be elected as mayor of our beloved city back in the 1990s, if you will, and what conservatives said after Mayor Sharon Sales Belton was upset in her attempt for a third term in 2001, that there won't be no Negroes running nothing out of City Hall again for the next 50 years, and they are probably correct. St. Paul, which is a good Irish Catholic town, has never had an African-American, but they have had a number. In fact, at one point in the first councilmatic district in St. Paul, for over, 24 consecutive years, that we had an African-American on the city council, starting with a guy by the name of Bill Wilson, not related to Judge Edward Wilson. That pattern continued for 24 years, and then, 12 years ago, an Asian won that seat, and then African-American won it back, and then the African-American left halfway through his term. He's now named Melvin Carter. He's now trying to run for mayor of St. Paul. Yes, he may have a pretty good chance, but we give you that background so that you have no illusions, if you will, about what kind of wonderland we really live in up here in God's country, if you will. A place that is as white as the white-driven snow of November, December, January, February, March, even April, if you will, snow here in April this year. All of this important as to analyze if there will be disturbances, if there will be an uprising, if you will, if blacks will take to the streets. Now, if it was going to happen, it would have happened Friday night. The verdict came out at about 3:04 Central Daylight Saving Time. Over 2,000 people, 65% of who were white, marched on the freeway, marched to the governor's mansion, if you will, marched for the next couple of days, marched to the site, the memorial site of Mr. Castile's death, if you will, which has been turned into a large memorial. But by the time that, in my estimation, and I've certainly been here a long, long, long time, once nothing happened really on Friday night, and we also were having a peace summit here that was being put together in a desperate attempt to start a process of peace and to end the violence. We have had basically already this year 16 individuals, and you have to realize we are a city of just a little over 400,000. We've already had 16 individuals shot and killed. We've had over 200 and some shootings already. The last two here in Minneapolis, the last two African-American women, young women, that were shot and wounded were paralyzed, if you will. We have had a grandmother, 62-year-old black grandmother, shot and killed last year. And again, we've had over almost approaching 300 shootings. In other words, people have been shot. You know what I'm saying? And so we are, you know, a symbol of the days of Tombstone and Abilene and Dodge City and places like that. We are the Wild Wild West. People really don't quite care. They're not really not concerned because we, as African Americans, sons and daughters of the African, are considered property. And of course, as we know, under the Constitution and the laws that govern us, that Your property has no value other than that which is placed on it by the persons or the corporations that own the property, if you will. That's how you come up with slavery, if you will. And so, contrary to what some of you around the country and around the world may think, we are not a very liberal enclave. We pretend. I mean, we do well in pretending. I mean, we talk a real good game here. But the African American community is under siege. Even our Native American brothers have warned us of the impending danger. The overall physical health of African Americans is terrible. We may be right behind Flint, Michigan in regards to, you know, bad water, bad air, and such things as that. The level of diabetes and cancer and et cetera is enormous. Health-wise, African Americans here in the state of Minnesota are at the bottom of the totem pole in regards to health. That's the reason that, you know, the whole health care battle that is going on, if you will, is so crucial to African Americans across the country. And in states like Minnesota that are extremely white, if you will, the African American does not have a great voice and consequently does not have significant power, if you will, to do what needs to be done to preserve being of the sons and daughters of the African. And these, again, are things that we are kind of told that we should talk about as African Americans and things like that. Of course, clearly there are African Americans here who have no problem talking about it. And in fact, that's what this program is all about. I have no problem whatsoever as a long-time activist, if you will, and head of organizations and et cetera, and being involved in many of the prime issues over the last 50-some years. Sometimes people will text and ask them, and how old are you, sir? You talking about? We celebrated in January of this year our 78th birthday, and we feel very blessed, you know what I'm saying? And we feel that the good Lord has kept his hand on our shoulders to allow us to continue to be functional, active, and we think once in a while effective, if you mean. In fact, for those that want to get a feel that, you know, that you're not listening to somebody who's just talking and pulling your leg, because there are, by the way, 24 Ron Edwardses who have websites in across the world in the United States. In fact, I have a namesake who's white, who is a rear admiral in the South African Navy. But on this past Sunday's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, you will see on the front page a quote by me talking in terms of the effect that the Castile verdict has had on us in the African-American community and what it has done to this current young generation of African-Americans who really didn't see this coming. I'd like to say that our young people saw it coming. They were ready to wheel and deal and et cetera, but they really didn't. They thought because history started when they were born that how they envisioned their dream, if you will, that that's the way it would be. It was cut and dry. There was video showing Castile being cut down and et cetera. So, you know, nothing else needed to be done but the jury to be selected. In fact, many of our young people, though far too many of them have been through the criminal justice system, they have not been involved in the jury process because of their age and the way things are done. And if they are not certified as an adult, they don't get a chance to see the jury system. And we noticed an atmosphere of young African Americans were startled when they started asking questions, how come there weren't more black people on the jury? As we indicated earlier, there were only two black people. One an African-American, the other a young 18-year-old Ethiopian sister who had been in this country about 10 years, if you will. In fact, at one point, And the judge had to kind of, he had to kind of, you know, talk to him about it, and kind of had to warn the two white attorneys, Kelly and Gray, because as they were questioning, if you will, during the voyeur with the young Ethiopian sister, they even implied that she didn't have enough intelligence to understand the complexity of the American judiciary system. Well, that holds true for a lot of lawyers that have their shingles up and practice law. I don't know how some of them got their law degrees, because they are a walking disaster as it pertains to being effective, if you will, really knowing how their law, it's their law, it's Anglo-Saxon law with a sprinkling of Norman law, sprinkled in, but it is Anglo-Saxon law. They are Anglo-Saxons, if you will. How is it that they are such a failure at understanding their own law? Let me also leave our audience with this. We've had some fun with it in our columns and our television programs and etc. We threw this question out there on this program about 3 months ago in a conversation, particularly with a regular who calls into our program that goes by the name of Mr. M. And I asked this question, and we all had a kind of a good laugh. And I'm hearing so much, particularly in another terrorist kind of some kind of attack. Looks like we almost had a terrorist attack at the airport in Flint, Michigan today. We our prayers go out to the Flint police officer who was stabbed in the neck. It appears at this hour that he is still alive and ultimately will recover. But one of the questions we ask, and we ask this question, we'll ask this question now every third or fourth program. We keep hearing, radicalization, that all of these brown-skinned people, these Arabs and et cetera, have been radicalized. What folks are really saying, they've been radicalized against the Christian Bible, because folks really don't care about the Quran, if you will. But I've asked this question as an academician, if you will, and as a historian, because I find no documentation anywhere which indicates so many white Americans and other Europeans are so vehement in their disdain for people of color. And so the question is, who radicalized them? Was it the white church? Was it the white education institutions? Was it their, God forbid, but that's kind of the suspicion, was it their white families, if you will? Was it their mothers and fathers, grandfathers and grandmothers, great-grandfathers, great-grandmothers, and et cetera? Was it, again, was it their secret societies and et cetera that they belonged to, the Masonic orders, the Shriners and such things? That who radicalized, particularly here in America, who has radicalized white Americans to carry the kind of hostility and racism that they carry against the franchise of the sons and daughters of the African, if you will? Now, for those of you that are extremely astute and that you pay attention to what is being said, what is being talked about, et cetera, I think there are some of you that have been present in the classroom places that you have seen this. It comes under different headings, such as white privilege, if you will, consciousness, if you will, white demands, but primarily under white privilege, the sense of privilege. But in the case of privilege, who was it that was able to take a combination of that, by virtue of the fact that you are quote-unquote a Caucasian / white, that you have privilege that does not exist for any others? Who radicalized you to defend that? Because one of the things that has happened on this planet over the last 2,000 years is that the Caucasian has done a beautiful job of quote-unquote incorporating certain philosophies and doctrines into such things as privilege, if you will, white right, white might, and et cetera. But they've always stayed away from, and what really has brought it into play is the whole situation with Islam and the whole debate back and forth about radicalization and et cetera. So I've been doing some research, if you will, and there are certain documents and books and et cetera that you can access if you can find them. And I basically determined as a historian at what point in time the radicalization became a doctrine that the decision was made by the monks, oops, and the friars and et cetera, that it needed to be disguised. And those great edifices there in the mountains of northern Italy and Switzerland and et cetera, they are great books, volumes of books and et cetera, in which the non-ecumenical has not been able to come in contact with for a long, long, long time, in which in some of those books, which are now considered to be taboo, if you will, not open to the non-secular or anybody else, are is time that the whole issue of the use of radicalizing, poisoning the minds of individuals, not only on the basis of religion, because what basically the keepers, if you will, of the manifestos and et cetera attempt to do is to make it appear that the greatest issue was religion, if you will. That's not what it was. Particularly as the conquistadores and others brought back the great wealth of those nations, particularly in Central and South America, that were being plundered and false indications of relationships and respect and et cetera was being abused. There were documents, materials that emerged that ultimately, though it took them in some cases 80, 100, 200 years for the so-called great white minds to fully dissect, if you will, analyze and begin to realize how other religions were developing and creating their cultures and et cetera. It's one of the reasons that, for whatever reason, that the Western world has had such a great problem in China, if you will, and that part of the world, if you will, be it Mongolia or be it as far south as Vietnam and even into the islands of Indonesia and et cetera. But it was China that held its ground with regards to maintaining its cultural greatness, if you will, that information, that knowledge that allowed a certain level of purity. Key word, by the way. You also will find that in some of the writings in some of the abbeys and some of the great facilities there up in the high Alps, mountains, if you will, under the direct control of the Vatican, if you will, of Catholicism, etc. But we bring that forward because, and I know it may be difficult for some whose minds are not prepared to accept the fact that the sons and daughters of the African, whose great, great, great civilizations were also on the same page as our brothers in the East, if you will, in Asia Minor. But recognizing what it was and how the greatness, if you will, the enlightenment of other civilizations, particularly other cultures and et cetera, were so ruptured and then fragmented, if you will, because of the desperate attempt to marginalize, to dismiss, to push aside the greatness of other cultures, particularly based on race, not religion, but on race, if you will. And so today, here in our own beloved Shangri-La, if you will, there is much discussion going on about being able to thoroughly read the mind, quote unquote, of the sons and daughters of the African. Now, those who talk about doing that in the great edifices that are, quote-unquote, their great palaces of intellectual greatness and et cetera, at least in their minds, they do not recognize that people of color, be they in Asia or Africa or South America, Central America, or in the Pacific Ocean and the once great empires of the Polynesians and et cetera, to say that there is still a maintenance that takes place in which the culture of these great civilizations have been preserved. And boy, that is the key word, preserved, if you will, because so much of the history, particularly coming out of South America, Central America, and Africa, particularly Black Africa, was purged, if you will. See, we have a tendency to not totally understand time and the box, if you will, the five-cornered box, if you will, that time is pressed in, if you will. that's a little inside joke with regards to those that really understand the Masonic doctrines, the Masonic orders, and et cetera, and how things are switched around as people talk in terms of the symbols, if you will. Though the Masonic things, if you will, that the Shriners and others are so proud of and feel are so secretive, all of them came out of the so-called cultures of Egypt, if you will. Sometimes take a look at the configurations, if you will, that are used by the white Shriners, if you will, and those that have been found in the deep sands of Egypt and across North Africa, and down towards Amarubi and Timbuktu, which folks make jokes about, but Timbuktu was a very great cultural center in the western part of Black Africa, Northern Africa, etc. So all of these things are tonight at play here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Folks are trying to figure if there will be some kind of explosion, if you will. Is there, quote unquote, a plan afoot to do something that will jeopardize and threaten, quote unquote, the continued existence and prosperity, if you will? If there is, don't expect us to tell you. let it be a surprise to you. But these are important times and yet challenging times for the sons and daughters of the African, if you will. We are a nation, as we move to the final 90 seconds, we are in a situation with that we have a demagogue in the White House, if you will, in Washington, D.C. And if we're not careful, we will see ourselves under a very repressive regime by a man who, quote unquote, cares nothing about what some think are the values of the United States of America. Thank you once again for allowing us to be with you, to come into your homes, if you will, onto your computers, if you will, both locally and internationally. We will be back next week. Hopefully our colleague, Mr. Allen, will be able to join us. If not, we will continue to move on in a continued examination of race, not only in America, but race across the world. And watch out, the Russians are not fearful of the United States of America. God bless you, Black America. Continue to stay strong. I'm Ron Edwards. This is the Ron and Don Program. Good night.